Welcome to Learning English on The Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we hear our programs Ask a Teacher and American Stories. But first, a few other reports. Here's Jonathan Evans to start us off.
President Donald Trump's administration declared this week that teachers in the United States are critical infrastructure workers. The declaration means that school officials could send teachers back to the classroom even if they were in contact with people infected with COVID-19. On Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said for the first time that teachers should be on its list of critical infrastructure workers. The list also includes healthcare workers, police officers, and people working in meat processing centers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention states that such workers are not required to quarantine for 14 days following COVID-19 exposure. It said they can keep working if they show no sign of the disease and take safety measures. Among the first areas to name teachers as critical infrastructure workers was Greene County in the state of Tennessee. Greene County school system officials approved the move on July 13th. It essentially means if we are exposed and we know we might potentially be positive, we still have to come to school and we might at that point be carriers and spreaders, said Hillary Buckner. She teaches Spanish at the high school in Afton, Tennessee. Only kindergarten and pre-kindergarten students currently attend class face-to-face in Greene County. But school officials could expand in-person classes to every one of the area's 7,500 students, Buckner said. In the state of Georgia, Forsyth County schools also recognized teachers as critical infrastructure workers. Spokesperson Jennifer Crossiolo said that means they could be told to return to classrooms. She noted that the 50,000-student school district has yet to rule on the issue and plans to decide on a case-by-case basis. A spokesperson for Georgia Governor Brian Kemp said his administration is studying the new Homeland Security Directive. But if it is accepted, the directive could influence other school districts to follow Forsyth County's example. Craig Harper is director of the Professional Association of Georgia Educators. He said the directive starkly contradicts the newest Georgia Department of Public Health guidance intended to protect student and educator health and curb spread of the virus. Lily Eskelson Garcia heads the National Education Association. She said the directive was an attempt to give President Trump and those governors who are disregarding the advice and guidance from public health experts an excuse to force educators into unsafe schools. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten added, "The Trump administration will always try to change the rules to threaten, bully, and coerce." If the president really saw us as essential, he'd act like it, Weingarten said. Teachers are and always have been essential workers, but not essential enough, it seems, for the Trump administration to commit the resources necessary to keep them safe in the classroom. The Associated Press reports that the coronavirus is spreading in Georgia as a percentage of population, faster than any other state. Tennessee has the seventh fastest spread. A few schools that reopened for in-person classes in both states have already closed after infections were reported among teachers and students. It is unclear whether the virus was spread at the schools, however. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Foreign worker Yulia Endang says she is saddened by the quick growth of COVID-19 cases among foreigners in Singapore. The increase started in April. Endang says she believes poor housing conditions where foreign workers live likely led to the increase. But she hopes the bad news will warn the island nation of dangers ahead. I hope the attention is not just attention, but a signal that outside there are more people aware of how actually migrant workers' life is like, she said. At one point, Singapore had the most COVID-19 cases in Southeast Asia, even with its small population. It worked hard to flatten the curve. But later, there was a surprising increase, mostly in dormitory rooms that house foreign workers. The rise was a reminder to Singaporeans that the wealth of their state depends, in part, on foreign laborers who often live in very poor conditions. In April, Singapore was reporting as many as 1,400 COVID-19 cases a day. It is now reporting as few as 200 new daily cases. Singapore acted to change the living conditions that increased the spread. The city-state announced a quarantine on foreign dormitories and tested every single person who lived in them. Singapore also plans to expand health services for foreign workers, and it plans to build more housing to lower the number of people living in each dormitory. Some foreign workers have already been moved into new buildings. Plans include 8 new buildings by the end of the year. Singaporeans are looking for social change to help correct what has historically been a place divided by class and wealth. One group is fighting against the "not in my backyard" attitude, often called NIMBY. It is an attitude that prevents new housing for the poor from being built in wealthier areas. Some Singaporeans have organized to change the attitude and expression to "welcome in my backyard" or WIMBY. The WIMBY group was formed after the COVID increases. It hopes to create relationships with foreign workers and others in Singapore. The WIMBY group wrote on Facebook, "We must not be comfortable with the idea of riding on the livelihoods of others for the success of the economy." I'm Susan Shand.
Hollywood has been slow to get its cameras rolling again as California starts easing coronavirus restrictions. Only a small number of movie and television productions have restarted filming in California and other parts of the United States. Actors and crew members are unsure when projects might restart filming, and some expect they will not return to work until 2021. Los Angeles County is home to the biggest movie and TV production companies in the country. The local government gave approval in June for filming to begin, with safety measures in place. Major labor unions released a 36-page report describing those safeguards. Producers had hoped to have many projects working again in August. The number of filming permit requests in the Los Angeles area since mid-June was more than 60% lower compared to a normal year. Most of the requests were for advertising or still film images, reported local organization Film LA. The group said it expected more television shows and movies to restart filming in September. A few big movies have restarted production in other countries. The next Jurassic World dinosaur film from Universal Pictures restarted filming in London. And Walt Disney Company is back at work in New Zealand, producing another film in the Avatar movie series. To restart, producers must meet the industry's COVID-19 guidelines, which takes longer for bigger projects. "It's not like flipping a light switch," said Duncan Crabtree Ireland, chief operating officer and a top lawyer for the actors' union SAG-AFTRA. The union has approved more than 1,000 return-to-work plans for film and TV projects, Crabtree Ireland noted. He added that the current production level was far lower than normal. Continuing shutdowns will limit the supply of fresh programming that television stations and online media services can offer. The crew of Amazon Studios series The Boys recorded a video urging people to wear face coverings to reduce coronavirus spread. "You want a Boys season 3? They are not going to let us shoot until we get the numbers down," actor Jack Quaid said on the video. Some TV series have taken steps to increase safety protections, including smaller crews, safety officers, and some unusual fixes. For example, some producers are using mannequins for kissing scenes. Producer Tyler Perry created a camp quarantine at his Georgia production studio to film his series Sistas in July. No coronavirus cases were reported during a 2-week shoot, Perry said. ViacomCBS, owner of MTV, Comedy Central, and other stations, is setting up closed sets called COVID compounds to make shows, said Chris McCarthy, a company official. "In the compounds, we will control it, we'll test, but we'll also contain it and keep everyone as safe as possible," McCarthy said. A few productions have reported coronavirus infections to SAG-AFTRA, Crabtree Ireland said. He would not identify the productions. "Some temporarily halted production," he said. Other cases involved people who had not yet reported for work. "In our view, It's a sign the system is working, he said.
This week, we answer a question from Evelio in Colombia. He writes, why is a sort of men's underwear called long johns? Thank you. Dear Evelio, when I looked up the history of the term long johns, I found it was first used in World War II by American soldiers. Many words that we use today, or are considered slang terms, came from the soldiers in that war. World War II was fought in many areas, including Europe. Because parts of Europe get cold in winter, the U.S. military gave soldiers special underclothing to help keep them warm. This underclothing covered much of the body, even the arms and legs. The soldiers called it long johns. Long johns are believed to have been named after John L. Sullivan, a famous American boxer in the 19th century. Sullivan wore a similar-looking piece of clothing when he competed in boxing matches. It is also worth noting that Americans sometimes call long johns long underwear. And in parts of the U.S., people may use the term long john when they talk about a kind of baked sweet that looks like a bar. This treat might help you stay warm in cold weather, too. And that's Ask a Teacher for this week. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now it's time for An American Story. We hear part one of Benito Sereno by Herman Melville.
Captain Benito Sereno hurried aboard his ship. It was ready to sail. A bright sun and a soft breeze promised good weather ahead. The ship's anchor was raised, and the San Dominique, old but still seaworthy, moved slowly out of the harbor of Valparaiso, on the west coast of Chile. It was carrying valuable products and slaves up the Pacific coast to Callao, another Spanish colonial port near Lima, Peru. The slaves, both male and female, slept on deck. They were not chained because their owner, Don Alejandro, said they were peaceful. The San Dominique moved steadily forward under a clear sky. The weather showed no sign of change. Day after day, the soft breeze kept the ship on course toward Peru. Slave traffic between Spain's colonial ports in this year of 1799 had been steady, but there were few outbreaks of violence. What happened, therefore, on board the San Dominique could not have been expected. On the seventh day out, before daybreak, the slaves rose up in rebellion. They swept through the ship with handspikes and hatchets, moving with the fury of desperate men. The attack was a complete surprise. Few of the crew were awake. All hands, except the two officers on the watch, lay in a deep, untroubled sleep. The rebels sprang upon the two officers and left them half dead. Then, one by one, they killed 18 of the sleeping crew. They threw some overboard, alive. A few hid and escaped death. The rebels tied up 7 others, but left them alive to navigate the ship. As the day began to break, Captain Sereno came slowly, carefully, up the steps toward the chief rebel leader, Mbabo, and begged for mercy. He promised to follow Mbabo's commands if he would only put an end to the killings. But this had no effect. Mbabo had three men brought up on deck and tied. Then the three Spaniards were thrown overboard. Mbabo did this to show his power and authority, that he was in command. Mbabo, however, promised not to kill Captain Sereno. But everything he said carried a threat. He asked the captain if in these seas there were any Negro countries. None, Sereno answered. Then take us to Senegal or the neighboring island of St. Nicholas. Captain Sereno was shaken. That is impossible, he said. It would mean going around Cape Horn, and this ship is in no condition for such a voyage, and we do not have enough supplies or sails or water. Take us there anyway, Mbabo answered sharply, showing little interest in such details. If you refuse, we will kill every white man on board. Captain Sereno knew he had no choice. He told the rebel leader that the most serious problem in making such a long voyage was water. Mbabo said they should sail to the island of Santa Maria, near the southern end of Chile. He knew that no one lived on the island, but water and supplies could be found there. He forced Captain Sereno to keep away from any port. He threatened to kill him the moment he saw him start to move toward any city, town, or settlement on shore. Sereno had to agree to sail to the island of Santa Maria. He still hoped that he might meet along the way, or at the island itself, a ship that could help him. Perhaps, who knows, he might find a boat on the island and be able to escape to the nearby coast of Arauco. Hope was all he had left, and that was getting smaller each day. Captain Sereno steered south for Santa Maria. The voyage would take weeks. 8 days after the ship turned south, Mbabo told Captain Sereno that he was going to kill Don Alejandro, owner of the slaves on board. He said it had to be done. Otherwise, he and the other slaves could never be sure of their freedom. He refused to listen to the captain's appeals and ordered two men to pull Don Alejandro up from below and kill him on deck. It was done as ordered. Three other Spaniards were brought up and thrown overboard. Mbabo warned Sereno and the other Spaniards that each one of them would go the same way if any of them gave the smallest cause for suspicion. Sereno decided to do everything possible to save the lives of those remaining. He agreed to carry the rebels safely to Senegal if they promised peace and no further bloodshed. And he signed a document that gave the rebels ownership of the ship and its cargo. Later, as they sailed down the long coast of Chile, the wind suddenly dropped. The ship drifted into a deep calm. For days, it lay still in the water. The heat was fierce, the suffering intense. There was little water that made matters worse. Some of those on board were driven mad. A few died. The pressure and tension made many violent, and they killed a Spanish officer. After a time, a breeze came up and set the ship free again, and it continued south. The voyage seemed endless. The ship sailed for weeks with little water on board. It moved through days of good weather and periods of bad weather. There were times when it sailed under heavy skies, and times when the wind dropped and the ship lay becalmed in lifeless air. The crew seemed half dead. At last, one evening in the month of August, the San Dominique reached the lonely island of Santa Maria. It moved slowly toward one of the island's bays to drop anchor. Not far off lay an American ship, and the sight of the ship caught the rebels by surprise. The slaves became tense and fearful. They wanted to sail away quickly, but their leader, Babo, opposed such a move. Where could they go? Their water and food were low. He succeeded in bringing them under control and in quieting their fears. He told them they had nothing to fear, and they believed him. Then he ordered everyone to go to work, to clean the decks and put the ship in proper and good condition so that no visitor would suspect anything was wrong. Later, he spoke to Captain Sereno, warning him that he would kill him if he did not do as he was told. He explained in detail what Sereno was to do and say if any stranger came on board. He held a dagger in his hand, saying it would always be ready for any emergency. The American vessel was a large trade ship and seal hunter, commanded by Captain Amasa Delano. He had stopped at Santa Maria for water. On the American ship, shortly after sunrise, an officer woke Captain Delano and told him a strange sail was coming into the bay. The captain quickly got up, dressed, and went up on deck. Captain Delano raised his spyglass and looked closely at the strange ship coming slowly in. He was surprised that there was no flag. A ship usually showed its flag when entering a harbor where another ship lay at anchor. As the ship got closer, Captain Delano saw it was damaged. Many of its sails were ripped and torn. A mast was broken, and the deck was in disorder. Clearly, the ship was in trouble. The American captain decided to go to the strange vessel and offer help. He ordered his whaleboat put into the water and had his men bring up some supplies and put them in the boat. Then they set out toward the mystery ship. As they approached, Captain Delano was shocked at the poor condition of the ship. He wondered what could have happened, and what he would find.
And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.